And it's this thing you know you haven't gotten to yet, right? As you're building these poems. And as you're seeing, like, how they, like, laying them out on the floor and seeing how they do and don't play well with each other and what conversations emerge and questions keep recurring and so on, and you know you're not there yet. And by they, we mean Bianca.
This microphone also reminds me... Oh, maybe I should put this... Are we recording?
Yeah, but...
Okay, well, this microphone reminds me of a story my grandma used to always say about the asparagus farm. Because you know how asparagus grow, like, straight up from the earth?
Yes.
And she would always say, you know why you see all those Polish women squatting in the fields.
Ick, I saw that one coming.
That's too bad. That's too bad. I didn't know if I wanted to see something sort of phallic here or more like
it's breast. It's hard not... Breasts.
Yeah, but a small breast, like a
oh, like starting here,
like a Gez breast.
Yeah,
I'll tell not you, starting here.
What? Not starting.
It's just really like
that's
a
noodle. That's a.
I think it's hard to avoid
the aged breast,
the phallicness of a mic.
I'm glad I'm sitting here with. Take it,
Julia Gez and Emily Brandt. Have come to Vermont from, they're both in New York City right now, to visit the Roustone House and play with me in the rivers and, read some poems. Thanks so much for being here, guys.
Thank you, Bianca.
I want to read your bios. Emily Brandt is a poet of Sicilian and Polish and Ukrainian descent. Born and raised on Long Island, she's the author of 3 chapbooks and co-founding editor of No Dear, a really incredible magazine. Curator of the Lineage Reading Series at Wendy's Subway and an instructional coach at NYC Public Schools. She earned her BA in psychology, I didn't know that, English and women's studies from Boston University. She also got her MFA from New York University, where she facilitated the Veterans Writing Workshop, a wonderful program, and she lives in Brooklyn with her love and their dog, Gnocchi.
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 Little dumpling.
And...
I wonder what my name is.
Julia. Is your bio in here?
Yes.
Okay.
But I don't know where.
Julia Gez's poetry, essays, interviews, and translations have appeared in Poetry, The Guardian, Penn Poetry Series, The Canyon Review, BOM, and The Brooklyn Rail. She's been awarded the Discovery Boston Review Poetry Prize, a Fulbright Fellowship, and the John Frederick Nims Memorial Prize in Translation. Gez holds degrees from Rice and Columbia. For the last decade, she's worked with Tech for America, and she's currently a managing director of programming there. She also teaches creative writing at Rutgers and writes poetry reviews for Publishers Weekly. I didn't know that either. She lives in Brooklyn and can be stalked online at www.juliagez.net.
Mm-hmm. Not stalked.
Well, that's what I do. That's what I would do. So I wanted to talk a little bit. You both had books come out in time for the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so it's been an interesting time to promote it, I'm sure. I wanted to start by just talking about each of your books, the titles, and how it really came to fruition. One thing we've been talking a lot about is the sort of manuscript creating journey.
Mm-hmm.
How long that takes for you, what the evolution of the manuscript was like, and what were some of the themes maybe that you were really trying to bring forward. Emily, why don't we start with you, with your book, Falsehood from After Hours.
Sure. So this manuscript definitely went through a lot of pretty radical iterations. And though a good portion of it was written in like a 2-year span post MFA, there are also poems in here that are older. And so a big piece of the work in creating this was selecting and editing and ordering around this theme of how growing up in a white suburban community sort of infiltrated my consciousness, even though I think I was always pretty aware that there was something very strange about this environment. And so I was really looking at how space impacts a life and was gathering poems that I'd been writing over, you know, a decade without knowing necessarily that that was one of the things I was writing about.
Right. You were just sort of writing about your experiences that you've lived.
Yeah.
And then you're not really sure what that means yet.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And then I realized I was, like, paying attention in a particular way to, like, a particular form of, like, white supremacist patriarchal repression that manifests in all sorts of spaces, you know, temporal and actual, but manifests in a really particular way in the suburbs.
That's an interesting and difficult theme to tackle in poetry, for sure, if you're going to come at it literally and mm-hmm. narratively. And I feel like what I love about your book is the poems really just lay a lot of the foundations plainly of what it was like growing up there without judgment, and it lets us really do that work of drawing these obvious conclusions where, you know, it wasn't all a bad experience simply because it was because of the implications of our culture and the sort of underlying problems with it. But they constantly are bleeding through in the poems from many different directions. And I feel like the perspective, I feel like there's a lot of the child mm-hmm. in the memory that comes through here. Mm-hmm. And there's something really unique about the child's experience of what the adults are doing that illuminates so much more. I wonder why we gravitate towards that in our poems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, especially in the first half of the book, but that felt really, like, essential for me to go into to my personal experience, and is a lot more interesting for me to go back to where I was, like, presently living these experiences. One of the things I tried to do consciously while writing and revising these poems to sort of help me access that, like, kid brain was vacillating between, like, hyper form and revision, and then, like, hyper rejection of form and revision. So I would, like, some of the poems I would just tinker with obsessively, like, changing the amount of, you know, syllables or words per line or lines per stanza or sound patterns, and just really, like, leaning really heavily into form to see what that could activate in terms of not necessarily memory, but more so like a intuitive experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then let that all go and really, like, meditate and write the poems over the course of, you know, an hour or two to write a poem, but just by sitting very still and letting whatever was going to emerge from the back of the brain emerge onto the page, and then barely revise it. Like, maybe just for the sake of some clarity, or to, like, trim a bit of fluff.
Interesting.
And that for me was helpful in terms of, like a compress and release, to kind of almost, like, squeeze out that child voice, because it's not, you know, it's not in the foreground anymore. I'm 40.
Right. Well, I think both of those tactics are essential in writing poetry in general, right? So mm-hmm. you have to have this sort of, like, mm-hmm. free association, no thought state. And then you also have to have the hyper-editor state, right? In order to... I mean, both those are essential in, like, the mm-hmm. ultimate creation of a poem, which comes off as something quick and perfectly thought and still mm-hmm. very ambiguous and full of meaning... that continues to occur as the reader is reading it. But it's interesting to really pause and think about, like, how all of that works. It's really not just one way that we write.
Right. And I think often it's more of a even split for me, where like there's like the drafting and then the revision. And I think this book pushed me to like lean really heavily for different poems into different parts of that process, in a way that felt like a little bit obsessive, but in a
good way. Well, it's your first full-length book.
Yeah.
I think, you know. Okay, Julia, I would love to hear about your experience with your book.
You got it. All right, first I'm going to say that I love the way your eyes light up when you're talking about poetry. And I saw it last night. I don't even think you blinked, like, for that entire bonfire we were, like, going around reading poems. There's just, like, a particular quality. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's this, like, something childlike, but just very joyful and very awake, very alive to it. So it's cool to know that conversations about poetry can do to you and for you and with you what poems do.
Yeah.
The piece about the book is, so first you asked about the title.
An Invisible Glass Case, which is also a frame.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that title.
I stole it from Diane Arbus. It had been like 18 months without a married date night. And I don't know how many children we had. It must have been two because we were very exhausted. But we knew that it had been too long since we had been to the museum. And we went to the Met Breuer, and Diane Arbus had this unbelievable show that ended in this like handwritten like broadside. It's like pencil she's working with or something like that, that mentioned that some of these photographs, which right now are worth quite a lot of money, and then she was selling like in little groups of 15 for nothing, would come in an invisible glass case, which is also a frame. And I thought, no, that's fucking perfect.
That is so fucking perfect.
And so that's where I got that.
That's like a book of poetry.
That's like a book of poetry.
It's Invisible Glass Case, which is also a frame. Mm-hmm.
That's a book of poetry.
Fuck.
Mm-hmm. And
a poetry comic.
And a poetry comic.
Mm-hmm.
It should be a poetry comic.
Yeah.
For the book, though, I wasn't building a book. I was building out very, like, aware that I was still working on building out phrases and lines and poems, mm-hmm. and finding the right words, or being given the right words to sort of spin a poem around. And that's what happened with that first poem.
Wait, can you talk a little bit more about that, what you mean there?
So Lucy Brock-Boida would give us like two or three words, and it would be like scarab, carriage. Do you know what I mean? Like
very Lucy words.
Right, exactly. No, I mean, and more along those lines. And say like, you know, I'd love to see a poem emerge from. She'd give us like 10 or 12 words.
Right. Mm-hmm. I love that. That's very similar to the poetry game, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's it. I was building poems. I was not building a book. Mm-hmm. This second time around, I knew I was building a book. I sat out to build a book. I literally built the book in the document that I was filling with poems.
Okay.
As part of a book. This one was, I was building poems.
Right, right. I mean, that's how the first book should be, in a way.
I like hearing that.
Yeah. Well, you don't know what it's like to build a book before you make a book, so...
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to... The focus really should be on poems more than book, and then... And the first book should be totally flawed as well,
mm-hmm.
right? Hopefully, so you can only get better.
Yes.
But I've never really thought about that, but it's completely true, just to sort of phrase it that way, that I was building poems and not a book. But of course, one always has the book sort of like as this fantasy in the future.
Sure. And it's this thing you know you haven't gotten to yet,
right?
As you're building these poems. And as you're seeing like how they, like laying them out on the floor and seeing how they do and don't play well with each other and what conversations emerge and questions keep recurring and so on. And you know you're not there yet.
Yeah.
And when you are and you stop fussing, you hope you have a book.
Right.
And you can stop gutting, and you can, you know, stop revising, you can stop penciling in, just leave alone, and hope it stands.
Well, also, when you gather up all the poems that and put them into a document, and you're like, here's my book, and then you're like, what I've realized now is then the book happens. Then I start writing into that, into that document, and then months later, the book has appeared out of what I thought was a book.
Yes, absolutely.
But I need the sort of course, you need something to start with, right? Besides, like, otherwise, there's no container for your poems. They're literally and metaphorically scattered, and you have to contain them first, and then you start to piece together the arc, right? And writing into the spaces that need to be filled,
right?
Mm-hmm. Fleshed out,
right?
Yeah. But I love the realization that books don't appear fully formed, and that once you make them, then they keep expanding, and the, in the editing process, for me,
right,
the book happens, I guess. So.
For me as well, and I remember screenshotting something you'd posted on Facebook not too long ago about, and I'll screw it up, but this is my version of this sort of wildness and this mystery and this, like, occurrence, right, mm-hmm. that is your imagination playing itself out on the page, right. Trusting that years of preparation and technique and craft will know what to do with this when it's time,
mm-hmm.
For them to enter into the whole equation. You had, like, a much cleaner way of putting that. Yeah, but do you remember what that was? It was like a part one and a part two.
It's something that I talk about a lot. But I think it reminds me of reading about, I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but it reminds me of reading about the Greeks and how much they revered poetry and how those two phenomenons were really highlighted in their education of what being a poet was. So, like, on one hand you have this, the muse, where you spontaneity and the wildness and the creativity occur on the page seemingly out of nowhere. But then there's also this element of the education that is actually really important and mm-hmm. serious and takes time and mm-hmm. dedication and hard work. Mm-hmm. And all of that is necessary, not just for the editing process, but preparing you to find yourself, to be able to listen to the muses and to be able to translate onto the page. Because so much of what mm-hmm. is learning how to listen to your own psyche as absolutely. It unfolds, because mm-hmm. it's all there, but it's like we don't know how to listen to ourselves, and we were told how to listen to ourselves in school, and of course that's, like, the worst way to listen to yourself, because that's like factory work level listening to yourself or something,
right? And then you end up listening to things that are not actually the self that right. you like other people. Think are the self, but they're not.
Yeah,
they're other people, right?
So back to your book, is I love that sort of words, single words, were really the origin of the poems, and then the book came. This very creation of the cosmos feeling to me.
Something in like
the beginning
that.
Was the word.
Right, right. Do you know Julia Shipley, that poet,
I do.
That journalist? She
yeah.
was based in Vermont for a long time. She's
yeah.
in the city now. She did this piece sort of on the book and on the many readings I did with the book right before everything
yep.
went sideways, and came to me once when we were meeting for coffee with a notebook sized piece of paper, and she said, "These are the words that I had to look up." And I was reading your book, and I thought, and I was so smitten to see them all, first of all yeah. together, and I thought, those are the words, right? I mean, yeah. I had to look them up, and, you know, and I had to spin these little, I don't know, spin this magic out of these words, which to me are magical.
Oh, I love that.
But it is a book that has these words, these, you know, anyway, this it has this lexicon. And I recognize that that's really off-putting for some. It's like some people do not enter a
difficult
space.
Difficult words.
Difficult words.
Yeah.
Or the being brought up and out of a particular moment of poetry, asking yourself, you know, what this Latin phrase is all about.
I know, it's such a workshop moment. This really took me out of the poem, you know.
Right.
The truth of the matter is that if you love language, you love language.
Completely.
You don't really have to know what it means.
Completely.
To love it.
But I think there's this place, so, and I love language, by the way. There are, like, three other things that I love as much as language, and two of them are downstairs watching Frozen. The other one is reading on the balcony, making sure that mountain doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
But there is this feeling that I realize I've been after and was very much after with this book. The second one means to make itself understood, make itself a little bit more legible, and make itself a little bit more immediate. Just because I didn't know how much time I was working with when I was working it out and wanted to use it well. But this book, this first one, much as it loves language, is trying to get to a place that exists before we understood much of it. Like at one point, hearing somebody read these poems, you shouldn't even hear the words as distinct.
Well, I was going to say, actually, just I think instead of language, it's actually about word. The, what I meant was words, right? Because there's a difference, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's a love of words, which there's a Wallace Stevens quote I just was using. Keep going, but I'll just bring this up.
No, I want to hear this quote. We all stop for Wallace Stevens.
In poetry, you must love the words, the ideas, and the images and rhythms with all your capacity to love anything at all.
I love that.
And words is first. So words before ideas, before images, before rhythms, before capacity. Mm-hmm. It's 100% this, because I think starting with an adoration of a single word and how much a single word can hold inside it.
Right.
And continues to hold throughout time.
Right.
Is incredible.
And completely.
So from that, a narrative began to unfold that surprised you?
Did what emerge
surprise
me?
Yeah, did what emerge surprise you? And you didn't... Did you have much intention behind what you knew was going to happen with these words?
No idea. None. I simply kept messing with them until there was some sense of completeness sonically, if no other way. I mean, there's a certain logic to them. I'm sure nobody else but me could sort of tinker with them long enough and unpack them and play with them and be like, how does this work? But yeah, I just mess with it until it sounded right. Mm-hmm. And then I would leave them alone. Because I actually try to keep messing with it. And I thought, no, that's all wrong. That's no good.
Yeah.
And I'd walk it out, or I'd do the laundry, or do something else sort of meditative, wash the dishes. And I'd try to add on to what I'd had memorized in my head. And I thought, I can't even remember it. I can't even take it in, right?
Yeah.
And integrate it. I think this is set.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're like a painter. Sounds like a painter.
I have poet friends who are painting. This is like a thing this last 18 months. And not like, not without some real seriousness and skill. I'm like, now what is happening here?
I think we've been branching out in our...
been doing what we can.
Yeah.
We have been doing what we can.
People have been knitting. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd love to hear an example. Julia, why don't you read us a poem first?
You got it. There's a birth poem here.
Let's have it.
That rivals something of Mina Lois. I think it's too long.
Okay.
But it's one of my favorites. I'm going to read a miniature. Let's do the one.
Sounds like we're in New York City with the traffic for some reason. It's like really...
That's how it is. Mm-hmm. Until like 3 o'clock in the morning, and then it gets really quiet until 4:30.
I guess it's a major thoroughfare.
Yes. 100 one, South.
Route 100 South.
There are not as
major
many,
thoroughfare.
I was going to say, there are not as many cars out there as there are on Nostrand.
Yeah, I know. It's
at like noon.
we're doing.
It's a place that you have to drive through to get to other places.
Yes.
Pum place.
I like places like that. All right, you ready? Mm-hmm. I'm the only person drinking water. Does anybody want some?
No.
It has a little bit of Aperol, but mostly lemon.
I'm good. Thank you.
Nothing? Good for it. All right. Still life with a Vicodin. Maybe there is no magic. No technicolor, but inside the seed there is a kingdom. Ask me anything, I will tell you the truth. It is a fatal wound for every wolf and thimble. Even the night watchman is not immune. We may as well sing George inside the throat, a carriage, a pony, a parachute.
You read that in the night. I really wanted to see the ending of it for some reason. Everything you're saying is so resonant looking at the poems. Because a carriage, a pony, a parachute. Those three things together, it's just like... It just feels so right. It feels so good in my mouth. I feel so embodied in it. In it, they're all inside a throat. They are inside my throat right now. A carriage, a pony, a parachute. And that rhythm, a carriage, a pony, a parachute, it's just like... And right before that, I could read this poem backwards and explain it. We may sing, George. We may sing. We're singing. We're singing by the end of this poem. Even the night watchman is not immune. It actually almost seems like a poem about... I mean, I think all poems ultimately are about poetry in a weird way. We're about how we're trying to communicate something through poetry. But maybe there is no magic, no technicolor. But inside the seed, there is a kingdom. Like the word is the seed. Maybe there is no magic occurring here. No flashiness. This is just a magic. This is just the seed full of potential. Ask me anything and I will tell you the truth. I love how I know that line is both a lie and complete utter truth, because mm-hmm. that's exactly what we're doing here. It is a fatal wound for every wolf and thimble. Oh. That line's just, then you give us that line, I feel like, because then you're like, okay, I'm just going to give you pure poetry line, like, right in the middle. I'm going to give you the myth right in the middle that is going to carry this poem. And even the night watchman is not immune. It's just like, I think this is a really good example, too, to, like, I'll put a picture of the poem up on the podcast page, but I think it's a good example for students or people thinking about editing their poems to, like, really hone in on the line, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, really think about... The way it keeps saying it is the economy of the line, the way... Mm-hmm. There's the incredible opportunity and use of exactly the space you have here. You're just meticulous about it. You're very meticulous about it.
There's one in here that I wasn't thinking to read, but that maybe I will, because it came from listing out a lot of words that I was really in love with, and then thinking a lot about, in the beginning there was the word,
yeah.
Right? And Adam naming the things and naming all of the this. Things. Yeah. So I never read this poem, but I'm going to read it now. It's called Attachment. What seems random is geometric precision, a pattern in a carpet, a car engine, infinite mother love, a turbine, here a stream, and the water is perpetually clear, is perpetual, is perpetrating, is purposed, a proposal, a sniffle, or something strawberry or cola, an elephant in a turnstile, a sabotage, a sneeze, a liminal space. I was always on the doorstep of unworthy, a challenge of gender, hermaphroditic. Does it count that I feel like this? Can I invent an origin story of myself, my genital, or is that one I don't get to write? My mother collected my birth on a typewriter. It's in a flat box on the shelf of a closet. A comforter, a sleeping bag, a crinoline skirt to hide in, fence slats, marshmallow in a jar, a touch of nasturtium, nostalgia, a pumpkin aioli, a shredded head of lettuce, a lucky charm, and a home on this range, this cul-de-sac, this unopened envelope, this trove, a fire set by a pirate to lure, a field full of men, and one woman's legs. Can I write her origin story? What is she called? What can she possibly be called?
That poem really chilled me. I felt utterly arrested by it. Can I invent an origin story of myself? Of myself, my genital? Or is that one I don't get to write? I love that the mother follows that so quickly. My mother collected my birth on a typewriter. There's so much in this book that there's so many details in this book that illuminate the speaker's life so vividly without being over-controlling at all. I mean, things like a pumpkin aioli, a shredded head of lettuce, a lucky charm, and a home on this range, this cul-de-sac, this unopened envelope, this trove. I just love the complexity of the description that, I mean, we're kind of getting at it before, but there's a real wrestling, there's a real battle going on with how they feel about all this.
Definitely, and I think there's definitely, like, a similar sense of, like, this is true but not real, right? Like, that it does the, you know, I love how poetry can create a logic that is utterly illogical.
Tell the truth, but tell it slant. Mm-hmm. Tell the truth, tell it slant.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's, like, that's the power and the perfect place to explore things like this. That's, you know, why, right, it's like a, it's memory. Memory is so involved with poetry. But it's perfect because poetry isn't beholden to facts. Right. And memory just actually isn't, fact doesn't seem to work with memory.
It's interesting that you say that, because hearing you say that makes me realize that some of the moments in this poem are, like, you know, variations of actual memory,
right.
But some of the moments are really about the memory of a word, right? Like, why is the memory of the first time I heard aioli coming to me so strongly? Like, and even though that's not in the world of this poem,
works, right? And especially how words work.
Mm-hmm. Right, and just to think about how, like, certain words are stored in different neuron streams in your brain attached to memories, feelings, ideas that they actually have very little to do with.
Right.
And that poetry is a place where, like, that...
It's associative.
Right, that associative nature is honored.
And it's so unique to each person, right? Mm-hmm. So, but then we have overlaps.
Right, because I think it, although it is unique, I think those overlaps are really real. I think that there's a lot...
I mean, things, words like cola.
Right.
You know, or, but even just car engine, mother exactly. Love, a sabotage, a sneeze, a liminal space.
They're going to have pretty similar...
But it's not even really about the overlap as much as it is just about, like, okay, these are our words. This is, like, we're all human. And our it doesn't really matter that our associations vary, because you lay it out here and I'm able to come in and read it and, like, glean your associations, because your associations are also on the page, because you're associating in time with the poem.
Right.
And then I'm associating as well in time with the poem. So we're both creating this third object, this other poem, the poem, the actual poem. So in that way, it's weird, because, like, the actual poem isn't the poem you think it is.
No.
It's not yours anymore.
No. It's ours.
Somebody said, was it on Twitter or was it somebody dead?
Yes.
I can't wait for a dead Twitter.
Fuck, I forgot it.
What was the thing, though?
Oh, once you... I entered into some argument. It wasn't even an argument. I just started blathering on somebody else's tweet that was about somebody saying, like, can you stop acting like the writer doesn't understand trauma like the reader does? And I was like, I don't make that assumption ever. But also, like, and then she said, we're all readers. And I was like, yes, we are all readers. Like, once you, and then, so the quote that I remember is, like, someone says, well, once you're finished the poem, you're the reader. Once you're finished writing the poem, you're the reader.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not your poem anymore. You're not the writer necessarily after that. You've given your poem away from yourself.
I think that feels true sometimes and sometimes not.
that it's not yours anymore?
I think it depends. At least for me, from my experience, if I'm understanding what you and your dead Twitter friend are saying.
God bless them.
Nothing happened.
I don't even...
I think there are poems that I experience that way, where it's like, it's done, I've let it go, and then I look at it, and like something different happens for me, where I'm like experiencing it.
But you're the reader now.
I'm the reader now.
Of your own poem, yeah.
But I do feel like there are other poems that I for some reason don't feel that way with. I feel like inside of them in a particular way that, like, I don't know.
Was it like your children a little bit, maybe, where they're not you, but you're still never able to fully separate from it, and try and influence it and raise it and give it the best goddamn laugh it's ever had. I want you to go out there. I want you to win all the prizes.
Bianca, that's why that poem is called Attachment. It's exactly that.
Okay.
You nailed it.
We got it.
You won.
Thank you guys so much for talking with me about your beautiful books and your poems and your thoughts and what you're working on. This won't be the last conversation. This is the first.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bianca and Julia.